Welcome to On Script's Biblical World, a podcast exploring the history, archaeology, geography, and cultures of the Bible. Visit us at onscript.study/biblicalworld.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Biblical World podcast. This is Matt Lynch coming to you from Regent College in Vancouver. We're finally releasing the third of our three-part series on the best finds of 2023. And although 2023 is now well behind us, we still think that hopefully this series is giving you a nice overview of some of the ways that significant finds in archaeology are processed and thought about and discussed in the scholarly world. And so I think you'll enjoy this last of our three-part series on the best archaeological finds, top 10 archaeological finds of 2023. So thanks for listening and for supporting us and for sharing the word about what we're doing here. Hope you enjoy it.
Welcome back, Biblical World listeners. I am Kyle Keimer, and today I am joined by my co-host, Chris McKinney. Chris, how are you doing today?
Kyle, I am doing well. It's been a bit of a gap between the top six and these top four because, well, I've been busy filming a movie in Colombia, Quest for the Throne of God, a documentary about the Ark of the Covenant. So we're still in the early part of 2024 discussing the best list of 2023, but a number of you in the audience have reached out about finishing this list, and so here we are recording the final part of the list. We're looking today at the Second Temple period, the best finds from 2023 in the Second Temple period. I'm excited about this list. What about you, Kyle?
I'm excited too. And you know what? I think sometimes it's good to make the audience wait. It just builds that anticipation. And so they just want it even more than they realized they wanted it before. So here you go, listeners. This one is for those of you that want this.
So we covered in the first two episodes of our top 10 biblical archaeology discoveries, we've broken it into three episodes, not just because we're talking a lot about it. We are talking a lot about it, so it makes for nice, lengthy episodes. But we've also tried to divide it up chronologically. So our first episode in the series dealt with the great Bronze Age finds that relate to the Bible over 2023. Our second episode dealt with the Iron Age finds, and there were quite a number of those. We also dealt with some of the bigger stories that didn't make it into our top 10 list, such as the ongoing discussion about the so-called curse tablet from Mount Ebal that we discussed last time. And this time, as I said, we're discussing the Second Temple period. That that time period is going to be from the end of the Iron Age, something like 539 BC, all the way through the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And we're kind of fudging the end of this to encompass all the way up to Bar Kokhba and a bit beyond, which is actually more or less the way these things are taught, to have post-Iron Age take you all the way up into or around the Byzantine period. We've given special attention to finds that have a direct impact upon the biblical story, or potentially have a massive way of thinking about archaeology in the Bible in the future. And so, just to give an example, if this was a list for 2024, one of the ones we would certainly consider would be the recent announcement of the first decipherment of one of the scrolls from Pompeii, which is an incredible discovery, just recently announced. In fact, it was prize-winning. There was a cash reward for this, and we can talk about that in a future episode. But that's the kind of discovery that I think is so significant and the kind of things that gets us excited, kind of out-of-the-box new discoveries. So as usual, we're going to start this list by talking about some honorable mentions. These are very important discoveries that didn't quite make our list. Our first honorable mention came actually in the form, not out of the ground, but through satellite imagery. This was a paper that was published back in the middle part of 2023 about a lost campaign, new evidence of a Roman temporary camps in northern Arabia. Now, this is interesting because it has to do with the conquest of Nabatea, this great Arab empire that existed from the 4th century BC and independently all the way up to 106 AD. Archaeologists and scholars were able to trace and find different Roman camps deep into the Arabian desert that they believe have to do with the conquest of Nabatea. Now, within the paper, they discuss other possibilities that perhaps this was related to earlier campaigns by the Romans against the Nabateans before 106 AD. And until they excavate it, they won't be able to know for sure. If they do go ahead and excavate some of these camps in Saudi Arabia, they will potentially be able to find very important datable material because of the very arid regions. Now, in terms of the biblical connection related to the Nabateans are not actually mentioned directly in the Bible. There's no place in the Bible, in the New Testament, that where you can just go and say, okay, well, let's read about, you know, these Nabateans. However, they are incredibly significant for the historical background of the biblical story. Herod the Great's mother, Kypros, for instance, was a Nabatean. And so, for instance, when Jesus and the disciples made their many treks to Jerusalem from the area of Perea, they passed right beside this fortress called Kypros, named after Herod the Great's mother. On the political side, they are an incredibly important nation as well, because they existed on the outer edges of the Roman Empire. And so for Herod the Great, or for the Tetrarchs, or for the procurators that had to take over from the Herods, they had to deal with this political reality. And one of the big things we find is Antipas actually getting into all kinds of conflicts with the Nabateans, and even losing a major battle against the Nabateans. There is one reference that we have to the Nabateans in the New Testament, not to the people, but to one of their kings. It says in 2 Corinthians, of all places, 11:32-33, in Damascus, the governor under King Aretas guarded the city of Damascus in order to seize me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands. This reference is odd. One, because Damascus was apparently at this point under Nabatean control, or perhaps Aretas was just in the vicinity at the time. We're not really sure, but we definitely know from Josephus and other sources of this figure, King Aretas, who reigned right around the time of Paul. Now, with the discovery, or I should say the annexation of Nabatea in 106 AD, the entire part of the Nabatean Empire actually reached its apex in terms of material culture, because the Romans were actually able to establish even better the trade routes using the Nabateans and bring trade all throughout the Roman Empire. And so it's a very interesting discovery with massive implications for how we understand the history of the region, and touches on some really important ways the New Testament story.
Yeah, great stuff. I would just add two things. And the first is going on with Paul, as you mentioned, right? In Galatians, when he gives us this kind of biography of himself, he says, I went into Arabia right away after this conversion event. This is the domain of the Nabateans. This is where he goes into their territory. And so there's a connection there. And then the second thing is the interaction between the Romans and the Nabateans. You know, why is there such interest between, or I should say, why is there such Roman interest? Well, the Nabateans are controlling this extremely lucrative trade that's coming from far reaches through Arabia and then to the Mediterranean. They're essentially the gatekeepers, if you will, of so much of this really lucrative trade. And if the Romans can actually tap into that, either controlling it directly or at least establishing really good relations with the Nabataeans, then they stand to benefit in a very great way.
Yeah, I think it's such a great point. And I think even some people have suggested that the Nabataeans may be in some way related to the Magi, you know, that there's some connection there. I think it's maybe a bit of a stretch, but by the fact that they bring frankincense and myrrh and these spices, the Nabataeans were the main people involved in that. So I think it's a great point. And to your point about Galatians and Paul going into Arabia, I'll just remind people of one of the first things we talked about in this top 10 list, which was the discovery of the name Sinai about 500 years or more before the existence of Moses and you know, the Israelites in the Exodus. And in that passage, which talks about Paul and Arabia, there is seemingly a connection where Paul is trying to make a connection between himself and Elijah and Moses, of having this Sinai experience where he has this kind of revelation or experience with God. He's trying to cast himself in that light. Now, it's also used by people who don't really, in my opinion, understand the historical sources to say, well, Mount Sinai should be in Saudi Arabia. Well, the fact is that Arabia as a term included both the area that we call Saudi Arabia today, as well as Mount Sinai, the region of the Sinai Peninsula in today, modern Egypt. And so when Paul says Arabia, he has the ability to just simply refer to this massive area. And even if he actually went into the area that we're talking about now, into Saudi Arabia, it would have called to mind the realities of where Mount Sinai is, in an area still under Arabia, but by all of the other evidence pointed to the area of southern Sinai. Well, our next honorable mention, don't want to spend too much time on the honorable mentions, but this is another very important one. I would have put this in the top 10 list if it had a direct connection to the Bible, but it didn't. I think if this is top 10 archaeological discoveries in Israel, it's probably on the list. It was announced back in August that archaeologists had found a Roman military amphitheater in Israel with blood red walls. This was found next to Tel Megiddo in the ancient Roman encampment of Legio. Its Arabic name, Lejeune, preserves that ancient name, Legio. This relates to a Roman legion that was stationed there sometime in the second century AD. So it's a bit after the time of the New Testament, but nevertheless, an incredibly significant find in showing the usage of this very strategic area of Israel, the area of Megiddo, the Megiddo Pass, and the entrance to the Jezreel Valley by the Romans after their conquest of the of Judea. So this is after the Great Revolt in 70 AD, and probably was sometime around or just after the establishment, or I should say the second revolt, the Bar Kokhba Revolt. And it's related to an ongoing excavation and archaeological project in the Jezreel Valley led by Matt Adams and several others that is seeking to find the contours of this encampment, as well as understand how long they were there and its impact. In terms of other discoveries related to this in the past, we have the first so-called Roman church, also called like a prayer house. It's called sometimes called the prison house at Legio, which is actually found inside of a jail, which is still being used right on the Megiddo Pass, just to the north, or I should say to the east of Megiddo. The significant find of this amphitheater shows that not only was this a place of entertainment, but it's primarily a training ground. What's significant about this from the larger Roman history perspective is that this amphitheater was used for soldiers to train, to fight with one another. One other word about the usage of these different terms. People often will say today, because it's the way we use it, that an amphitheater is a place for concerts or plays, maybe because it sounds like an amp, something to do with music, something to do with sound. But an amphitheater literally is always used for gladiatorial contests or battles. And what it really is two theaters put together. A theater is half of an amphitheater. Theaters are used for plays or musical events. An amphitheater is used for gladiatorial contests. The greatest one we have is, of course, the Colosseum, which has a connection in some way to this because it was built by Vespasian using the spoils from the destruction of Jerusalem and the conquest of Judea. Now, the last thing I'd say about it, which I find to be very, very interesting, is in Revelation 16:16, we have reference to Har-Mageddon or Armageddon. And at least in my view, this has to be connected with the site of Megiddo. And I think there's some very interesting connections that can be drawn out between the contemporary realities of late first century Judea, Galilee, connected with Roman soldiers and military in the vicinity that John, the Revelator, is, I think, drawing out in his discussion of Revelation 16:16 against the backdrop of stories from the Hebrew Bible, especially the death of Josiah at Megiddo, which happens in Chronicles and Kings. But that is a topic for an entire episode, or maybe a couple of episodes. So this has an interesting connection with some of that as well.
Yeah, I would just add that it's really great to see this find, and it seems that Legio is one of these sites that really was largely unknown until the last last couple decades. And now the more they explore, the more amazing things they find there. And you're right, it's improving our understanding of the Roman understanding of the geography. And they recognize that this is such a strategic place. And so it'll be interesting to see what else they are able to discover here in Legio.
Yeah. And if the archaeologists are listening and they want to get in our top 10 list again, I would recommend excavating more near this site at a place called Tel Abushusha or Tel Shosh, which I think is this site that fits in between the destruction of Megiddo sometime in the 5th and 4th century BC and the emergence of Legio, which starts in the early 2nd century AD. There was one site, Geba of the horsemen, that's near there, and I can't wait for the archaeologists to continue to see what's there. I think it potentially could be as important of a site as something like Sepphoris in the region, because of the sources talk about it as this very important Gentile Greek city next to Megiddo. Well, let's move on to our next honorable mention. We won't spend too much time on this one, but it is definitely worth noting. It is the Hukuk or Hukuk's fantastic mosaic scenes of biblical stories. This last year saw the final excavation of the synagogue at Hukuk that was led by Jody Magnus. And we're still absolutely amazed by the mosaics that continue to come from there, some of which are completely unique and never been replicated. They're amazing in terms of their detail and description. And so this was the last season, and they finally finished off the work there. Among the ones that were released and discussed in detail this year was a mosaic of Samson carrying the gates of Gaza on his shoulders to Hebron. In the depiction, Samson is depicted as an absolute giant. He's not shown simply as carrying just the posts of the gate, but the whole gate with all of the stones still intact. And we also have scenes of different battles and conflicts, probably related to the Hasmoneans and their conflict with the Seleucids, which once again is the only depiction of this event in a mosaic or in art, as far as I know. And so even though this wasn't, I wouldn't put this in the top 10 list, I think it remains one of the most important discoveries over the last decade or so. And it's worth noting that as this one comes to an end, this archaeological project will continue to reverberate with its amazing scenes and these amazing discoveries from Jody Magnus and her team.
Yeah, I just look forward to seeing more as they bring more of the material to light. So other than that, I don't have much to add for this one. It's super exciting.
Very exciting. Our last honorable mention, and I had this in the list, Kyle. You know, I had it right there, but then a discovery late in the game forced its way into the top 10 list. So this is a discovery far away from the land of Israel. It is at the entrance to one of the most important harbors in the Roman world, a place called Puteoli, which today is in Naples, the city of Naples, which I've had the privilege of visiting before back when I was a undergrad student and walking around Herculaneum and Pompeii. It's just an incredible place with incredible food, incredible environment. And this discovery relates to a submerged Nabataean temple right at the entrance to Puteoli. Now, what's so cool about this is, as we said earlier, the Nabataeans are far away from Rome. If Rome is the center in about 50 AD of the world, and it really kind of is the center of the old world, and it was the heart of a massive empire that spanned all the way in the northwest to Britain and all the way in the east to Nabatea, which it had trade relationships with, but had not yet conquered it. That would happen 50 years later. It's fascinating to see the presence of these traders, these Nabataeans, right at this major port. And the altar and the temple that have been found there mention the name Dushara. Dushara was the chief god of the Nabataeans, and he was worshipped all throughout Arabia. Now, in this case, this particular find does have a direct connection to the biblical story. And if we're thinking of Paul and his experience of life in the Roman Empire, many of you have been to Turkey and Greece and gone through and seen a lot of the sites he would have seen and experienced. Some of those get mentioned directly in the Bible. Some of those are indirect. In this case, we know that Paul, on his way from Caesarea to go before Nero, to go before Caesar, he passed through Puteoli. So he made his way all the way across the Mediterranean, stopped off at Crete, a shipwreck on the way at Malta, made his way up Syracuse, around the boot of Italy through Regium, and then lands at Puteoli. So the two ends of this destination were Puteoli and Caesarea, which also shows us not only was Paul as a prisoner going to Rome, and from there, by the way, Acts 28 tells us he walked over land to Forum of Appius, three taverns, all the way to Rome, but it also shows us why the Nabataeans are there, because this is the great trade route of bringing goods to and from Rome. And so if you think of Paul landing at this harbor, surrounded by Roman military personnel, as well as perhaps some of his own servants or helpers, such as Luke, who is writing the book of Acts, he could have very well passed this temple to Dushara of the Nabataeans. Now, back in the 18th century, in the 1700s, an altar of Dushara was also found. You can still see that in the Naples Archaeological Museum. These types of finds, I think, are so fascinating and really get to why I think archaeology is such an important source for the Bible, because it just fills out this world in ways that are realistic and make us feel much more engrossed in this bigger story.
Yeah, and this is a really nice opposite end of the spectrum, if you will, from what we talked about earlier with the Roman camps in Arabia. Here we have Nabataean temple in Rome. And so it's just yet another indicator of the interaction across this extremely broad geographic space of what's going on. And trade is flowing. Trade is important. It also gives us insight into, you know, the Roman desire for this international trade and also their allowance of worshiping other cults. So it gives us a whole lot of background information that just continues to fill in the picture that underlies so much of the New Testament, and particularly what Paul is writing about.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're done with the honorable mentions. We're ready to get to our number four in the list. And this one was announced in the fall when four Roman swords were discovered in a cave near the Dead Sea. Now, the story behind this was really interesting because they weren't really there looking for swords. Why they were there was to find an old inscription that had been seen before, I think, by Pesach Bar Adon in his surveys around the Dead Sea. And so while they were there exploring it, they came across this cache of swords that were very distinctive in their style, very clearly Roman. Some of the scabbards were still preserved. And I just will say some of the best weapons that that have been found from this part of the world related to the Roman era. Now, in terms of what they are, these four swords and a spear point, probably these were swords that were captured by Jewish rebels in about 132 AD. This is the period of time known as the Bar Kokhba Revolt, the second great revolt done under Simon Bar Kokhba, in which they tried to throw off Roman rule. By this point, the temple had been destroyed for 60 years, and the Romans had been heavily involved in all throughout Judea, and most especially the city of Jerusalem remained strongly in Roman hands. For instance, the 10th Roman Legion resided near the area of Zion Gate and produced all manner of new structures. We still find all kinds of 10th Roman Legion bricks scattered throughout there. There's evidence of this, for instance, in Jaffa Gate. When you walk in, hang a left, go down to one of the restaurants in one of the tunnels. And I mentioned the 10th Roman Legion. And in fact, even the existence of David's Citadel, the tower that's in David's Citadel relates to the destruction in 70 and the ongoing control of the Romans of Jerusalem. And so about 132 AD, Bar Kokhba and his forces began this rebellion against Caesar Hadrian to try and overthrow them. The end result of this didn't work. And as we move through history, this is the time in which the land of Israel, which was then known by Judea, this region, all of it becomes reconstituted under the name Palestina. And the city of Jerusalem itself is renamed after the family of Hadrian, Aelia, and after the chief Roman god, Capitolina, that is, Jupiter of Capitolina, the Capitolina Hill, the chief deity that has a temple in the heart of Rome. And so a lot of people don't think about that when they think about the renaming of Jerusalem. To name it after the conqueror of Jerusalem, the new family, and then to name it after Jupiter, which is, again, Zeus, which, you know, Empire Strikes Back. This is Baal, according to most of the other earlier sources. This did not sit well, and that led to the revolt. So if we get back to the story itself, we do know that the former caves and hiding complexes, many of which existed in 70 AD, were reused again by Jewish rebels 60 years later, and many more ones were created. And it's thankful to these caves and their deposits that we actually have a lot of information about the Bar Kokhba revolt. The thing I always like to say when you encounter such a great discovery is, good for us, bad for them. Because it means that whoever hid those swords there never came back to use them, most likely because they were captured and killed or enslaved. And so in any case, if this particular event, the Bar Kokhba revolt, is an incredibly significant archaeological event, and it's incredibly significant for our understanding of biblical archaeology, not only in terms of what it can tell us about thinking about Roman military personnel in the generation just after the close of the New Testament, but about closing the door on any real idea of Jewish independence and any real idea of a rebuilding of a second temple. It's not going to be for another 200 years or so, at least what we know historically, where there's going to even be the possibility of a rebuilt third temple. And this happens under Julian the Apostate after Constantine. And so it's if we're thinking about this formation period of the New Testament and what's in and what's out, and, you know, is Jesus right about the destruction of the temple? And what does that mean? And what does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to be a Jew? Should you fight in the Bar Kokhba revolt? Should you not? All of these things are right on the table. The biggest thing that's unfortunate about all this is we do not have the heir to Josephus. For Josephus in the 70 AD destruction, we have two versions of a long history, the War of the Jews and then the Antiquities of the Jews, where Josephus gives us one written right after the events in probably 75, and then 20 years later, the blow-by-blow things that are happening. We have to rely on a bunch of other sources to understand the Bar Kokhba revolt. And so this particular discovery sheds considerable light on what would have happened then.
Yeah, I would just add on to that last point. It's such a great snippet, because that's what we really get with this period, is we get little snippets here and there. And granted, there more and more. It seems like we're discovering more and more material relevant for this time period, hiding caves, coins, inscriptions, the sword, so on and so forth. And so it's giving us greater insight when we are lacking these historical sources. And so everything that comes from this period archaeologically is super beneficial for reconstructing some of the ins and outs of what may have been taking place.
Yeah, and I would just say, even for those of you who are visiting sites or dealing with some of the archaeological material, knowing about the Bar Kokhba revolt can be really helpful. If you've ever been to Herodium, for instance, and you're there to understand why Herod the Great built it and what's its potential connection to the Bible, well, you end up spending a lot of time looking at stuff that was carved out by the rebels under Bar Kokhba. It also is helpful because in some instances, things that are considered to be part of the Dead Sea Scrolls actually date to the Bar Kokhba revolt. There are several caves near where this one was that have produced different documents. One of the most famous one is the Cave of Letters, which has this really nice cache of marriage documents, divorce documents, land ownership documents, especially with this woman named Babatha, who lives in the vicinity and mentions places like Zoar and so on. It was, I think, 2 years ago that the discovery of a scroll of Zechariah was found in these caves related to Bar Kokhba. So it's just a very important event to kind of keep in the back of your mind. Now, I had one other point that I just like to digress from when we talk about the Bar Kokhba revolt, and that has to do with the name itself. Bar Kokhba is Aramaic, and it means the son of the star. This is probably not his name. He was probably, his real name is something like Simon Bar Kozeba, which unfortunately for him, Kozeba means like liar, but it was actually a place. So you could actually call him, and the sources do, Simon. Is he Simon, son of the star, or is he Simon, son of the liar? Because he didn't actually become the Messiah. But my question then is, why would he want to have the name Simon, son of the star? And the interesting thing is because if we look at Numbers 24, 17, which is the Balaam's curse that turns into a blessing for the Israelites, we find this Gentile prophet who's essentially a mercenary hired by Balak of the Moabites looking at Israel. He's told to curse them, but he blesses them instead. And at really the peak of his final blessing, he says something about a mysterious figure that he sees coming in the future. And this is what he says. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. This prophecy, which happens in the days of Moses, had a colossal impact upon messianic typology, messianic thinking. We find it in, of course, the book of Matthew. In the book of Matthew chapter 2, the Magi are asking, where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage. Now, around the Christmas season, people are always asking, what is the star? You know, is it an angel? Is it the Shekinah glory? Is it a star? And I think that's an interesting discussion to get into with where and what exactly it is. And I think there's probably some interesting answers there. But in terms of its textual background, it very clearly is connected to Numbers 24. And it also is connected with this idea that the Messiah will have a star that shines brightly. What's interesting to me is not only do we see this within the biblical account, but we also see it in the artwork of related to early Christians. For instance, there is a sarcophagus which makes the Magi consult with Balaam. Like, where is the star, Balaam? Tell us about the star and what we should do to go find it. It's also something we see cross-culturally in Rome. Julius Caesar, for instance, died in 44 AD, and just after his death, a comet appears above Rome, and those at the time remarked that this is Julius Caesar's star, and it was believed that this was the deification of Julius Caesar. And so when Caesar Augustus tries to make himself emperor, when he tries to solidify his stance, he calls himself a son of the god, Julius Caesar, and they make coins depicting Julius Caesar with a special star. And so this whole concept of the star is not just something we find in the Bible, it's something we see cross-culturally. And I'm just going to go here. in perhaps my favorite of all of the interrelationships between what we see in The Lord of the Rings and in the biblical account, we have Samwise Gamgee, when he is about to fight Shelob, he's holding a light of the star, and he looks up to the heavens and he sees the star of Arendil, the one who is going across the heavens with the star of the Silmaril on his brow. If you go throughout all of Tolkien's work, this was actually one of the biggest and most important stories he wanted to tell and never quite finished. But this idea of this prophecy, and I was literally reading that this morning in the Fall of Gondolin, of these prophecies that a star will rise and pierce the darkness. And it literally refers to this this character. So we see it's something that captured the imagination, not only of Romans in terms of seeing stars connected with a divine king or a king who would be promised, but it has captured the imagination of the greatest fantasy writer and creator of myth of our era as well. Now, taking that all back to Bar Kokhba, didn't work so well for Bar Kokhba. He was captured at Beter, killed, and eventually his rabbi, the one who supported him, Rabbi Akiva, is also going to be killed, according to at least one source, flayed alive, in the area of Caesarea. So it goes to show you, though, the importance of how they were seeing this term of star. And so when people took those swords to this cave, perhaps they had in mind the idea that they were rallying behind the Messiah. As it turned out, it didn't turn out that way for them. Well, let's move on to number three. This forced its way into the list. This is a discovery that was announced back in November of 2023, and it is called, at least according to the newspaper article, "Archaeologists have found, perhaps, traditional home of Jesus' apostle by the Sea of Galilee." Of course, those of you who have listened to this podcast or are familiar with the recent discoveries of biblical archaeology may well be aware of the ongoing excavations led by Moti Aviam and also strongly supported by historical geographer and New Testament scholar Steve Notley of the site of El Araj. Now, the discussion about the identity of Bethsaida, the second most important city in the Gospels behind Capernaum in terms of the stories of the Gospels, this debate has been ongoing for decades. The reason for this debate has to do with the excavations of a nearby site just to the north of El Araj, on the north northern part of the Sea of Galilee, a place called Et Tel, where Rami Rav of the University of Nebraska at Omaha has excavated a very large and important site that is called in Arabic Et Tel, that he has identified with the biblical New Testament town of Bethsaida and published it under that name. It's about 2 miles to the north of the Sea of Galilee. And at least in our opinion, I'll speak for Kyle, it is very problematic in terms of an identification for the ancient site of Bethsaida. So there's a lot we could go into in terms of, you know, why El Araj is the most likely location. I would say just two quick things about it. One, it's close to, very close to the sea. In fact, depending on how much rain it is, it may be in the sea. Last time I was there, we couldn't get to the site because you would have to walk through about a foot of water along the road. And so it's right next to the sea, and it has considerable first century remains, as well as very important Byzantine remains. And it's actually those two features that are related to this discovery. A couple of years ago, the archaeologist announced the discovery of a large Byzantine church, which dated to the late Byzantine period, to the 7th century, and actually has an inscription on it claiming that the church relates to St. Peter. Now, this alone, I think, is a key feature in identifying the site with Bethsaida, because Peter, Andrew, John 1:44 says that this was the city of Andrew and Peter. And in fact, one can make a case that perhaps half of all of the 12 were from Bethsaida. Philip was from Bethsaida, certainly. It seems, if you read John carefully, James and John also could be there, and perhaps Nathaniel, who Philip mentioned, who meets a little bit later. So perhaps half the disciples are from this town. So with this discovery, it seemed to make a connection with the site even stronger, mostly because we have a reference to this church in late Christian sources from the period. Now, the big problem with the excavation of El Araj is the fact that it is so close to the sea, and the Sea of Galilee, which is a freshwater lake, can rise depending on the amount of rain, depending on the snowdrift, the snowmelt that comes down from Mount Hermon. And at different periods, the site was flooded by silt and as well as water, which covered up different parts of the site, which makes excavating it very complicated. Now, with all of that, again, we can say it's a very important Byzantine site. It's also a very important Herodian site. There's one more important thing to mention. At a number of sites that are related to early Christianity in Galilee, archaeologists over the years have been able to trace churches built directly over earlier remains. especially in the central part of that church. A great example of this is, of course, what I like to call the Millennium Falcon Church at Capernaum. Sort of, it was built in the 80s and sort of looks like Chewie and Han Solo are about to jump inside of it. It has a window in the floor that looks down to a series of churches, the earliest of which is a church built around a first century home, which is called an insula, that, at least according to archaeologists, we can say perhaps venerated this this building. We have something similar happening, although, as far as I know, not mentioned in ancient sources, happening at Nazareth in the work of Ken Dark, which shows a church with the Sisters of Zion, our building built over a first century cave and some structures there that, at least according to Ken Dark, and I think he makes a very good point, or good case for it, could be the veneration of the first century home of Jesus and Nazareth. And so the archaeologist, Aviam and Notley, the scholar, decided that they would excavate within the church at El Araj and focus their attention at the focal point, the apse at the back of the church. And they found a series of walls from different periods, including one that dates to the first century. And so it's their contention that this church was built not only as a memorial for St. Peter, but that it was built over ruins that were venerated, tracing all the way back to the first century, which doesn't necessarily mean that this is for sure the place where Peter would have lived. But what it does mean is that people in later periods believe this was the spot and it dates to the right time period.
Yeah, this is all really interesting. And you know, we're going to do a whole episode on some of these Byzantine churches at some point in the future. But the thing I would just highlight again is the fluctuating levels of the Sea of Galilee have just made this debate about the location of Bethsaida such a contentious thing. And as we now have a growing amount of evidence from El Araj, the water level of the sea in the first century would have been lower. And so there is clearly a substantial site that is located there against any claims that the water level would have been higher and actually come up much closer to the site of Et Tel further to the north.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's such a great point. I mean, if you look back before these excavations, people were saying that the remains found at El Araj just in survey had somehow fell down the hill and floated, I guess, from Et Tel. And there's depictions that show the Sea of Galilee flowing all the way up to Et Tel. This evidence clearly demonstrates that that's an impossibility, and that when these remains were here, the shoreline was to the south and below. People don't live in water unless they are in Avatar, Volume 2.
Or Waterworld, good old Kevin Costner.
Oh.
Movie. So people might have had gills back then, too.
That's right. Bring it way back. Bring it way back. Well, we'll look forward to seeing what else will come from El Araj. Maybe new discoveries could jump into our top 10 list. But let's move on to our last two. This one, I think, is an incredible discovery. Not much information on it, though. It comes from the Scientific American, where they announced the discovery of the personal theater of Nero. It was discovered near the Vatican, and it was part of a salvage excavation that, again, for a luxury hotel. And the once again, like we talked about with the amphitheater in Legio, this is not a typical type of structure for the Romans, but it has a personal and distinctive use. This one is distinctively for Nero. So this was his theater. So if you wanted to have someone play for him, or if he wanted to play himself, Nero was a lot of things, but he was also considered to be a renowned musician. At least that's what the records speak of him. In fact, this probably gets reflected in the famous line that Nero played the fiddle while Rome burned. Well, if Nero had a fiddle, which is impossible because they weren't invented yet, and if he were to play it, he may have played it in the theater, which was here. Now, why I consider this to be an important discovery for biblical archaeology is because anytime you find something directly related to a biblical character, I think that is very significant. Now, we've known a lot about different aspects of Nero's reign for a long time. This particular theater was known about through historical sources, and so it's been something that archaeologists have been looking for quite a while. And so this adds more information to what we've known about Nero. But in terms of the biblical story, and if we think about some of the things we've just talked about, Paul is on his way to Rome in Acts 28. In fact, the New Testament never mentions the name Nero by name. It mentions the name Caesar. But if you think of the book of Acts being written from the contemporary reality of Acts 28, every reference to every reference to Caesar has the connotation of Nero behind it, because that's the ultimate destiny of where Paul is going to end up. One of the things I think that is very significant when we think about the book of Acts is Jesus' words to the disciples when he's on the Mount of Olives, that I'm going to go up and I'm going to go and I'm going to come back someday, but you're to stay, and the gospel is going to go forth from Jerusalem, Judea, to Samaria, and then to the ends of the earth. That is an outline for the book. That's exactly what happens in the early chapters with Peter and Philip, and you go into different parts, including Samaria and so on. And then as you transition to Paul, it's going to the ends of the earth. And there's this progression, whether we're talking about the first, second, or third missionary journey, where Paul is trying in some way to take it to Rome. And in some sense, the book of Romans is all about that. It's before Paul's gone, but it's trying to get the gospel of the kingdom. Now, in Luke Acts language, this is incredibly important, because Luke starts his story in Luke chapter 2 writing about the gospel, the good news, and a savior and a son of God. So if we go back to some of these same ideas about Caesar Augustus, who called himself a son of God, who called himself a soter or savior, who depicted himself as having a gospel or good news that's gone to the ends of the earth, which would be, in this language, to the eastern part of the empire, right up next to Nabatea. Well, in the gospel story of Luke Acts, this new savior, this new son of God, this new conqueror, if you will, Messiah, is sending a new gospel the other direction, and it's reached the front door of Caesar. And so it's just very interesting, if you look at the big picture of Luke Acts, what it's doing is showing, it's really casting the entire story as the two gospels of the two emperors, the two saviors. And we find that even though Jesus is dead, he's the main character of the entire book of Acts, and it's his spirit that's directing Paul at each stage, and not just in kind of like an ethereal way. Like the text says, the spirit of Jesus told me to do this, to bring that gospel right to the doorstep of Rome. And so, again, if we think of Paul, he's ending up there. If we think of what we just read in or talked about with Peter, he is, at least according to tradition, killed by Nero, and John 21 probably hints at that as well. So to me, this is a great discovery and allows us at least to think about the real environments that Peter and Paul, as well as the bad guys in the New Testament, would have inhabited.
Yeah, and I think anything with Nero is really important, because as you've hinted, he's not mentioned by name, but so much that underlies so many of the New Testament writings has Nero in mind. Even jump to Revelation, and you think about the mark of the beast, the number of the beast, 666, or in some version 616. Well, if you do your gematria, the number thing, both of those numbers add up to the name of Caesar, Nero Caesar, whether it's in Latin or Greek. And so that's why you get a variation in the number. But clearly, right, this guy had some major impact on early Christians. And of course, we know from historic sources, he's afflicting Christians, kind of the first official affliction, even if it's not empire-wide, He's creating problems for Christians. He's also kind of the height of arrogance, the height of imperial arrogance up into the first half of the first century. And he's just opulent. I mean, the details that we have about some of the things he wanted to build in Rome, a rotating theater. And I forget if that's actually supposed to be this one, but a theater that would rotate. You think of those restaurants that rotate, that's what Nero is doing in Rome, essentially almost bankrupting it. But then he disappears, he flees, and there's all this kind of mythology that arises around him that he's gone off to the Parthians and is going to come back at some point in time in the future and kind of retake over and ruin everything. And this is a myth that gets picked up by many New Testament scholars New Testament authors as well, that underlies some of what they're coming up against as Christianity is starting to spread through the Roman Empire.
Such a great point. And I think it's something that a lot of people are unaware of, that this myth of Nero was such a powerful part. I mean, and the reason why the myth really emerges is because he was such a figure that was a lightning rod for controversy. He killed his mother. I mean, had her killed, who got him the throne anyway, by having Claudius killed. But he's just such an interesting villain character to think through. And so if we think about what we've been talking about, even in the top 10 list, and we think about even the conquest of Nabatea in 106 AD, we see that, that's on the border of Parthia. That's on the area on the far eastern part of the empire, how a message of Caesar, a message of Nero, even a myth of Caesar could have these far-ranging impacts upon the story. Very, very interesting. Well, let's get to our last thing in the list. And as I said before, we've said that this list is not arranged by order of importance. We have 10 in this list. I don't know which one I'd put at the top. I might choose this one, actually, just because that's the kind of the way I'm wired. It's just so weird and yet so awesome in terms of its discovery that I would probably put it at the top. Maybe we can debate that at the very end. But without holding your suspense any longer, I'll tell you the number one.
Noah's Ark.
No. Noah's Ark. But it's not too far from here. It's in the same landmass, at least according to tradition. Our top in the list, anyway, number one is the 2,000-year-old synagogue found not in Capernaum, not in Jerusalem, not in Transjordan, not even in Turkey or Rome, but Russia, of all places. I think that this type of discovery, which was announced in only the briefest of news information about it, has come out probably because it's within Russia, didn't receive nearly as much eyeballs and acclaim as it should have. This is at a place called Phanagoria, which was a Greek colony that was established on the banks of the Black Sea, so very close to today the area of Crimea, just to the east, just across from the Bay of Azov. And it's here that archaeologists announced the discovery of a synagogue going back to the first century BC, which means this is one of our oldest, if not the oldest, synagogues ever found. And again, it's not next to Jerusalem. It's closer. It's in Russia. I mean, that's very, very far away. And so what does it tell us? It tells us that the diaspora, Jews living in the dispersion, was very spread out already before the time of the New Testament, that there was enough Jewish population in this Greek city on the banks of the Black Sea to warrant a synagogue, not just any synagogue, a synagogue with some of the best depictions of menorahs ever found from synagogues. And so we see a site that is actually even outside of the Roman Empire, a site that is fully connected with trade. And it gives us, I think, some insight into think about how big and broad ranging the biblical world is. And for me, as someone who also likes to think about the other literature, when we talk about the wider world of the Mediterranean, even in the mythologies that we have coming down from Greece, where we're talking about is far away from where they would have known this part of the world. It's here on the shores of the Black Sea that we have the famous quest of Jason and the Argonauts after the Golden Fleece. It's here, near here in the Caucasus, that we have Prometheus bound for giving a man the sacred fire. I mean, this is far, far away from Rome, far away from Jerusalem. And yet here we have first century Jews in the time of Jesus practicing Torah with menorahs, with all the things you would find, in fact, even better than we have found archaeologically in the heartland of the New Kingdom era. And so I think I'd put this on the top of the list just because it's so strange and cool and to see how archaeology can be very unexpected, lead to very unexpected discoveries and push the boundaries of what we know. And so to me, I'd probably put this at the top of the list.
Yeah, this one's pretty awesome for the, you know, all the reasons you're saying. It's so unexpected. It's so far away. And it just, I think, is going to shed light on the expanse of the diaspora. But also then it has implications, too, as we think about the spread of Christianity moving forward and the fact that in the New Testament, you've got, you know, we know there are Jews in Bithynia, like northern Asia Minor, northern Turkey already. And this is where some of the disciples go. But they've clearly gone across the Black Sea as well and expanded there. And so you're wondering how far the spread of Christianity then interacts if they're going from Jewish community to Jewish community. We also have evidence in the second century that that whole southern shore of the Black Sea had largely, at least to a certain degree, converted to Christianity from the writings of Pliny, a Roman author who goes there as an official. And so, again, that's right across the sea from this new site. And so it's, I think, just it'll be interesting what else comes out from this excavation and also how much data we end up getting reported. So it'll, I think it has some major implications.
Absolutely. So we await new discoveries. It'll be interesting to see texts, writings, mosaics. Hopefully all those and more will be forthcoming at this incredible site. So as we wrap up this episode and we think of our top 10 list, I think it would be good for us to read through our top 10. We won't talk about all the honorable mentions again, although we actually had more honorable mentions than our top 10 list was. But if you want to go back and listen to them, we have those discussions. But here was our top 10 list. We had three stories in the Bronze Age: New Indo-European language discovered at Hattusha, the earliest mention of the place name of Sinai, the massive Middle Bronze Canaanite monument at Tel Shimron. Those were our three big stories from the Bronze Age. Our Iron Age stories, there were three: an early Iron Age moat in the city of David, true purple at Tel Shikmona, and number five was the ancient Judahite DNA recovered at Kiryat Yarim. Today, we've talked about four stories related to the Second Temple period and later. We talked about the Roman swords discovered in a cave near the Dead Sea, perhaps Peter's house found in the excavations of El Arash or Bethsaida, Nero's personal theater in Rome, and a 2,000-year-old synagogue, which was discovered in southern Russia. That's our top 10 list for 2023. Time will tell what new discoveries will make it on our top 10 list for 2024. So let's see what happens over this next year.
Yeah, great. And until that time comes, I'll say what we usually say on script listeners, or sorry, Biblical World listeners, keep on digging.
You've been listening to OnScript's Biblical World podcast. If you enjoy this show, please show your support by giving us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen. You can support the show by visiting onscript.study/donate. Until next time, keep digging.